a show that's about technology and stuff, and it's really well produced. Thank you.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Greetings and welcome to this edition of Technology Bites.
Greetings, program.
Welcome to the show. All right, welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee. Oh, I see what we did there. I see what you did there. You led me to believe.
I'm Peter Hughes.
Yay.
Okay.
Welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm still Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And he's?
Groovehouse.
All right. The semi-perfect show. All right. Welcome to the show, everybody. We're glad you could tune in. Good night. All right.
Woo! So... Thank you, Houston.
It's so weird. It feels like, did we just have a geek gathering?
Last week.
Last Friday? Yeah, we sure did. Doesn't it seem weird? Doesn't it seem
That's
like it was
really
a while
odd.
Ago?
Yeah.
But it was really just a few days ago?
You just planted the seed of doubt in me, and I just fell completely for it. Yeah, that's
No,
like
it feels like
ago.
It was... I was thinking, do I need to get an announcement out for the next Technology Bites Geek Gathering?
Because
it
could.
Seems like it's been a long time since we had one, but we just had one Friday.
So everyone just had a really long weekend or a long work week, or what's going on?
I don't know. I know
been a lot
that,
of chocolate going. Bunnies ago since the Geek Gathering.
I think probably just because my work's been so weird.
That, and usually, I think what it is, too, is usually, I think, the last handful of geek gatherings, they've been later in the month. Just because, you know, that the first of the month might be, like, a Tuesday or, you know, something like that. So I think they've been, you know, hitting later, like, around the 7th and 8th
Indeed.
Versus super early.
I'll make it to one of them.
You said you're going to be at this.
Yeah,
I know. I was, like, right up to that day, I thought I was going to, and work just kept happening. I just wasn't able to break away. Couldn't bust out.
Money, roof over prison. Your head versus geek gathering. I mean, really.
Couldn't bust out of my home office work prison.
All right. Well, welcome to the show. You can visit us online at our website, which has all the Geek Gathering information you'll ever need at www.geekradio.com. Not sure what Groovehouse is doing. He looks like he needs a pair of headphones.
I just want a pair that works.
Groovehouse
Please
has got...
donate to KPFT so that we all have...
He has left the booth. He's left the booth.
The phones are unmanned.
Call now.
Panic.
Anarchy.
All right. And you can also hang out with us on IRC, irc.cuckoo.com.
Cuckoo.
In the channel Tech Bytes, if you are inclined to do the chat thing. We usually have a handful of people there. It is, as we call it, the show within a show. And it's always a good time there. Completely uncensored, but not unmoderated.
Barrett, why is your MacBook always running at like 100% with the fans on full blast? What is wrong with your computer?
I think because it when it first boots up, it wants to be a development server. So I'm pretty sure I've got like several... dev stacks running. I need to go. I'm gonna change this, but I'm gonna take this old one to out of the country first. Cause I'm not gonna go break my brand new MacBook Air
in Croatia
first
or something?
Week. Yeah, yeah. So we're gonna take this one out, and then when I get back, we'll get something new. Maybe that
it
doesn't
takes a lot of computing power to UU encode those brony videos to upload them to Usenet.
Well, I'm making my own videos. Is the main thing here.
It's the rendering. Really?
It's the rendering.
3DS Max.
It's the rendering.
Pony models.
Pony slash.
Fanfic. Actually, that's the thing I don't know about. What's pony slash?
We don't want
to
know.
You probably don't. Yeah, you don't want to get into it.
You have to ask.
Well, do you have a Google?
They just released.
Yeah, but I'm afraid. I've also got a browser history, and I'm going to log it onto my account first. Let's see.
They just released RenderMan, the rendering plugin.
Incognito
for
mode.
A couple weeks ago, so you could. You could upgrade your rendering workflow to include RenderMan now, and your brony slash.
RenderMan's
could
cool,
be,
but that sounds too much like
Pixar
SlenderMan
quality.
Now. Sounds too much like SlenderMan. I refuse to use the software.
SlenderRenderMan.
Who knows what else is installed in there? Oh, okay. Got it. Cool. Pony slash is completely safe.
Completely? Sure.
Is it?
It's a trap.
I think it's safe. I
feel bad for whoever is working on the KPFT proxy logs.
I'm only looking at.
Oh, this
hit.
Is a Groovehouse thing.
What?
What? It is. You should Google Pony Slash.
No.
I stay incognito mode first.
Stay gold.
Huh?
Stay gold, Pony Boy.
No, I'm serious. You need to Google this. I thought of you immediately.
Thank you.
And you'll know why.
Okay.
And it's not a bad thing.
Okay.
It's not one of those situations where I, you know, like it usually is, where I trick you.
Oh, I see. It's Pony Slash.
It is Pony Slash.
That's kind of funny.
I sold you. So Groovehouse, you know, when I think of Groovehouse photography, that's the thing he does when he's not manning the boards here at KPFT. He has a really good picture of Slash, you know, that I'm sure he's had, you know, and he's had blown up to twice its original size or three times. And
put it over the bed.
Shown it in some photo shows. Yeah, you know, it's a good photo.
Thank you.
I'm not a particularly big fan of Slash myself, but
Groove has a lot of good photos. I like his skate stuff over at Pink's.
Yeah, I think
I always like to look at that when I go
see
in there.
That stuff, yeah.
Those are pretty big too. I mean,
if you've been over to see Groove House's photography, you could call it at 713-526-573. All right, so yeah, so there's IRC, there's the website, phone number is 713-526-5738 if you want to chime in on any of the conversations that we're having throughout the course of the evening. You are welcome to do so. We'd love to have those calls. We're doing a little less tech support these days because, well, you know.
We fixed all the problems.
All the problems
They're
are
all
solved.
Done. They're all over.
And Pony Slash.
And Pony Slash.
We solved everything, and now
and
there's
Google.
Pony Slash.
If you're listening to Technology Bytes and you're enjoying the new format, be sure and tell a friend. Tell them that we don't suck anymore.
Tell two friends.
Tell two friends. All right, so...
make a blog.
nominate us for a Hugo.
Write one of those blogs.
I was looking at this before the show, and I have to compliment you, Peter. Our internal show prep page is actually fully HTML5 responsive, so I've been sitting here dragging the window back and forth, watching it resize
Open.
Itself. It's totally
Close.
Cool. I'm easily Open. Entertained.
Close.
He is so easily entertained.
So Open. Am.
Which is good for us.
And I put the links, the show links are on the front page of the site, so you can like look ahead and see what we don't talk about tonight.
You can fact check us and see how off we really are.
Well, you know.
Or read ahead and be ready to call in and add your two bits to the conversation.
Yeah, if you want to read ahead and familiarize yourself with the subject. This is like getting a photograph of the set list of your favorite band.
It's kind of like that.
Can
I
we
guess.
Wear our own T-shirts?
No.
No, okay.
We have to continue
I don't know
to
if
wear
anybody else
each other's.
Will wear them. We've worn the hell out of our own T-shirts in the past.
The best band set list story I have is I went and saw They Might Be Giants when they were touring on their second album. I didn't know that, so I just knew they were in town, and a friend of mine and I got tickets, and we went. And that was back when it was just the two Johns and a boombox. And so they had their set list was up there, and, of course, you know, the audience, somebody saw it. They, like, turned it around and showed it to everybody. And so then they came on, and they played their first song, and everybody started yelling, you know, yelling, quote, requesting the next song that they knew was on the list. And you could see them start to explain that, no, you know, this is on a, you know, that it's on a tape for the backing. And then they're like, oh, no, okay, yeah, we'll play that for you.
We're not prepared. All right, so what we're going to do now is we're going to go to the San Antonio news desk and do the Technology Bites info shots.
Boom!
And we've got some of the stories that Pete may or may not be covering are on the website at geekradio.com. So if you want to click on any of the links he's talking about in the upcoming segment, you have them available to you at geekradio.com. So let's do an info shot. Take it away, info shot.
It's the Technology Bites Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
All right, well, we have some not Happy Tunes news to start with. It'll get better. Just bear with us. No, I don't know if you've heard of Stingray. We haven't really talked about it a lot. But it is a device that law enforcement has that allows them to listen in on cell phone calls like in real time. Basically what it does is it pretends to be a legitimate cell phone tower to trick mobile phones and other devices on a cellular network into connecting up and revealing their location. Stingrays emit a signal that's stronger than the signal of other cell towers in the vicinity in order to force these devices to connect up with them and, you know, reveal their unique ID. And so they can use that to track your, you know, track locations of people in a way that, you know, you're not expecting just because you were using your cell phone and you're just out there in public. The thing that goes with this is that the company that makes Stingray has set up where a lot of police departments have signed non-disclosure agreements that prevent them from releasing records about the system or discussing it at all. In Florida, the U.S. Marshals Service went so far as to seize records about a local police department's use of Stingrays in order to prevent the American Civil Liberties Union from obtaining them. And many law enforcement agencies have apparently deceived judges about using Stingray in order to prevent defendants and the public from learning about how they're being used. Isn't that interesting? Apparently, now the ACLU has gotten some information in New York, but the police department fought very hard to keep them from getting these records. Apparently, cops in Erie County, New York, which includes the city of Buffalo, used the devices 47 times since 2010, but only once did they get a court order to do it, which contradicts what their county sheriff said last year when he said that the department only used them under, quote, judicial review. In the single case in which police sought permission from a court, they asked for a court order rather than a warrant, which carries a higher burden of proof. In other words, a court order is easier to get. A warrant requires some kind it has a higher burden to prove that it's necessary. The records which the New York Civil Liberties Union, the NYCLU, published in a blog post today also show that the county sheriff's office signed a stringent gag order with the FBI to maintain secrecy about their Stingray records. The department was told to withhold information about the devices in any documents filed with courts, such as affidavits and other documents describing how they obtained evidence in criminal cases. The department was even told that the FBI maintained the right to intervene in county prosecutions to request criminal cases be dismissed if there was a chance that a case might result in disclosure of information about law enforcement's use of stingrays. Something about that does not smell good. The fact that they are making these kinds of extreme efforts to keep the information from the public doesn't seem to fit in with things like our laws and constitution. So this one we will be paying attention to a little more closely going forward and seeing what gets found about this, the Stingray device. Clearly it must do more than just tell law enforcement where you are, or they wouldn't be going to the point of dismissing criminal cases to avoid any possibility that the information gets released. So there's that one. That's not a thriller to hear. I mean, you know, you kind of go, this seems almost worse than the stuff that we've heard from Snowden, except this one's in the hands of, you know, the county sheriff and local law enforcement. And now, while you're happy about that, here's a good one. As many as 1 million websites could be imperiled by a critical vulnerability discovered in WP Supercache, a WordPress plugin that generates static HTML pages files from dynamic WordPress blogs. It's the persistent cross-site scripting bug allows attackers to insert malicious code into WordPress published pages that use the extension. This came from a blog post published yesterday by security firm Securi. If you happen to have WP Supercache, you should immediately upgrade to version 1.4.4, which has fixes for the bug. What Securi said is, quote, using this vulnerability, an attacker using a carefully crafted query could insert malicious scripts to the plugin's cached file listing page. As this page requires a valid nonce in order to be displayed, a successful exploitation would require the site's administrator to have a look at that particular section manually. When executed, the injected scripts could be used to perform a lot of other things, like adding a new administrator account to the site, injecting backdoors by using WordPress theme addition tools, etc. Ouch. The bug is in the way WP Supercache displays information stored in the cache file key. In the vulnerable versions, user-supplied data was appended to the page contents without being scrubbed clean of any potentially malicious commands. So if you got a WordPress blog, make sure you check on what kind of caching software you're using and look this one up and do the update if it's needed. And in other malicious code use, a large number of ads distributed by a Google advertising partner redirected users to web-based exploits that attempted to install malware on users' computers. Dutch security firm FoxIT observed the malvertising campaign Tuesday when ads coming through a Google partner in Bulgaria called Engage Lab started redirecting users to the Nuclear Exploit Kit. Exploit kits are web-based attack platforms that try to exploit vulnerabilities in browsers and browser plugins in order to infect users' computers with malware. The Nuclear Exploit Kit specifically targets vulnerabilities in Flash, Adobe's Flash Player, Oracle Java, and Microsoft Silverlight. Fox IT researcher Martin von Danzig said Tuesday in a blog post, it appears as if all of EngageLab.com, its advertisement, and zone IDs are currently redirecting to a domain, which in turn is redirecting to the Nuclear Exploit Kit, indicating a possible compromise at this reseller of Google Advertisement Services. It stopped later in the day yesterday, which suggests that either Google or EngageLab took action, but they did not respond to request for comment. You know, the thing that's dangerous on this is that this kind of malvertising, to use the phrase from this PC World article, because it's tied to an advertising network, you're going to sites that don't have that you might go to every day that you never have problems. You would trust that site and you would visit regularly and you wouldn't think that it was the source of infection. because it's all through the ads. So that's why this is a big deal, and it's hard to, it's kind of hard to defend yourself against unless you just don't visit any websites, or I guess I wonder if an ad blocker would probably help. But one of the things is typical online advertisements go through 5 or 6 intermediaries before being displayed in a user's browser, and it can be replaced with a malicious ad or code at any point in that chain. Website owners also have no control over what ads would be will be displayed on their websites in way too many cases. So don't have an answer for what you should do on this, but certainly be aware of it. I don't think that, hopefully this Engage Labs thing was mostly a European affecting piece and not affecting us here, but we'll keep an eye, and if we see things about exploits on it, or if you just feel like there's any risk, run yourself a malware scan. You can find out all that info on geekradio.com. And then here's one, Bitcoin. You know how Bitcoin kind of works on sort of a trust system in a sense? And so to make people, to make it so that that it was more transparent and all of that, they came up with the Bitcoin Foundation. Well, apparently the Bitcoin Foundation is effectively bankrupt, according to one of its board members. It says the Bitcoin Foundation does not have control over Bitcoin itself. It is the closest thing to a public face that the community has. In a Saturday blog post, one of its members, Olivier Janssens, claimed that the group has been hiding its financial distress from its membership. He said the Bitcoin Foundation hates transparency. If they would have been transparent, then everyone would know there's no money left. Something I think the members have a right to know, wouldn't you think? Members have a right to know that the current board failed to tell them the truth and that their way of running the organization resulted in it going bankrupt. But instead of taking responsibility, they want to find the next executive director that will come up with another magic plan. Ironically, being transparent from the start might have prevented the whole thing to begin with. Not good things in the Bitcoin world. The Bitcoin Foundation has released a statement refuting some of Janssen's claims, but I think the damage is probably already pretty well done there. And finally, this one from the Clue Free Desk. Senator Dianne Feinstein, the Democrat from California, wrote on her website, there were two women were arrested who were accused of attempting to build a bomb. They wanted to be with ISIS or ISIL or whichever you prefer calling it. And so Dianne Feinstein has called for the Anarchist Cookbook to be deleted from the internet. She thinks it should be banned from the internet. Not only is this has it been in print for decades, you can buy it on Amazon if you're that interested in it, and has openly circulated online for nearly the same number of decades as it's been circulating any other way, which means removing it from the internet would be impossible. She says, quote, "I'm particularly struck that the alleged bombers made use of online bomb-making guides like the Anarchist Cookbook and Inspire magazine. These documents are not, in my view, protected by the First Amendment and should be removed from the internet." You kind of go, you know what? If it was a series of tubes, maybe that would work. But, just because two wannabe terrorists downloaded the Anarchist Cookbook doesn't mean that it should be gone. Apparently, in August 2014, the women discussed learning, quote, science. Let's learn the science in order to learn how to construct a homebrew explosive. Later, the women and the FBI agent who was the informant went to the library in order to begin teaching themselves basic chemistry. That should have taken a long time. By November 2014, as the women's research continued, the undercover agent told them that he or she had downloaded the Anarchist Cookbook. So the FBI, the FBI's employee is the one who gave them the book. So it's sort of a, it's a messy, stupid story. Like, oh, every banning the Anarchist Cookbook has been since forever. But this one's got internet in it, so there's that. And finally, this one, I don't know if you, if your listeners have maybe noticed that that you don't sleep as well anymore as you used to, and maybe you think it's because of getting old or something else. But another possibility is electronic devices wrecking your sleep. Late-night reading on smartphones and tablets bombards your eyes with artificial light, which makes your brain think the sun, you know, basically evolution, you know, our evolution hasn't kept up. When the blue light from those screens gets into your eyes, it makes your body and your brain think that it's a different time than it is, and then you go to bed and you don't get the kind of rapid eye movement sleep that is associated with peak mental performance. So there's three tricks that are suggested as sleep hacks to help keep your gadgets from ruining your sleep. One is, and this one's just, I think, is kind of funny. One is wearing blue blocker sunglasses at night, because what do blue blocker glasses do? They block the blue light, which is what screws up your what screws up your being awake or not, or being your body sensors on that. Number two is using the F.Lux program on your laptop and mobile devices, and what that'll do is make the screen look orange. Which, isn't it ironic that the screen looking orange is what happens when they prevent your eyes from thinking that it's the sun? Just think about that one. And then the third trick is the one that I don't that I know the least about, which is apparently daytime meditation helps. So you may want to pay attention. You may want to, you know, get the link from the get the link from the article and see about I don't know, installing F-Lux or getting some blue blockers. They're cheap. They're about $15 apparently. Or you can learn how to meditate. And that's the news.
I've actually been using F-Lux, or Flux, I call it Flux, for years and years and years. And I find that it helps. It's a little freebie app. And as far as I know, it runs on PC and Mac. But yeah, it works great. It adjusts the color temperature of the screen more warmer, I guess, as the sun goes down. And it's got a little, it watches the clock, and it can look up local sunrise and sunset times for your area, so it knows as it adjusts your screen, it's doing it in tune with the actual local sunrise and sunset. I like it. It's a neat little app. I think it helps.
So had you actually started having problems on sleeping that caused you to do that, or had you read about the possibility?
I'd read about the possibility, and I've been using it since 2008 or 2009.
Does it look at the moon phases?
No,
so after sunset it goes completely dark when it's a new moon.
Yes, yes, that's exactly what it does. And when it's
you
a new
pretty much
moon,
have to stop working.
You
at
can't
that
do
point.
Anything. The screen turns off. That's just how it is.
See, I fall asleep with my devices in bed next to me, like laptops and cell phones, which probably isn't good. But I do watch tennis matches before I go to bed to make sure I get all my rapid eye movement in.
Like you're like you're a vampire or something, like laying in bed with all your devices like around you.
Yes.
All lit. Ready just in case you open your eyes in the night. I don't know. Yeah, I guess you know that would probably be less weird than wearing blue blocker sunglasses around the house.
I mean,
unless
maybe.
You can convince your significant other that you're a big Roy Orbison fan.
Or if you're 80, I guess that's acceptable.
No. Something you said a minute ago on the subject of Senator Feinstein really twigged me. She said, you may have to go back and reread the quote. What did she say? It's not, she said, the things like the Anarchist Cookbook aren't, in my opinion, free
protected
speech.
By the First Amendment.
Well, thank God it's not up to her. Give me a break. That's like the most offensive thing I think I've heard in a long time, that this idiot senator who does idiot stuff thinks that, like, the First Amendment for a printed book is up for debate.
Technically, too. Let's just say, sure, like, that's bad. We need to get that off the internet. Where do you even start? I mean, there's no way you can take something off the internet. There's not a, you know, I don't think they have the internet kill switch yet. But,
maybe
you know.
Start at the Library of Congress.
We're gonna start with that. Lee already admitted to printing it out.
Right. Yeah,
I know I've got it on
like
floppy
probably
somewhere.
Probably 20 years ago, I printed it out on a dot matrix printer, and
the
I may still have it somewhere.
The Anarchist Cookbook?
Yeah.
Oh, I actually bought a, like a print, like a legit...
With the black cover?
Print with the black cover. It was like a 7th or 17th...
Well, most of the stuff
I bought it in 1990.
Most of the
so
stuff
it was,
in it doesn't work. Most of the
no,
stuff
it's
in
more
it is
novelty.
Like,
well,
says, novelty. How to build a blue box.
The explosive
well,
stuff
for 30 years.
Well, the explosive stuff I've heard a lot of people say, with specifically with the Anarchist Cookbook, you're about as likely to
blow yourself up
as you are to actually end up with some explosives. I know back in the day there was a much better version of it that made the rounds on the internet called the Big Book of Mischief.
Yes, that's the one, the BBOM. Uh-huh.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah,
yeah. Well, and thing, I had a copy of that. I don't know if I still do. But
the thing about the Anarchist Cookbook was, like, you know, I really didn't care. You know, I'm not interested in making bombs or doing
it
any of the stuff that's in there.
Cool.
But the fact that it was a banned book
made
me acquire a copy just because I was like, I want to have this.
It wasn't banned when I bought mine.
Clearly.
Was it ever really, really banned? Or was that just like, I haven't visited Snopes to see? Or was that always
know
like,
the
you know,
actual
like.
Official
I bought mine at a comic book store. I'm pretty sure.
Seems legit.
I worked at Half Price Books, so I
had to be able to order it out of the back of Rolling Stone, too.
Well, it was there was controversy around the book, and it was not always easy to get. I remember. There's some concern at some point that there were certain book purchases at bookstores that were being monitored. So if you bought with a credit card,
I remember hearing about that. Yeah, you got flagged.
Certain titles would flag on your credit report or on something. And so if the idea was that you had to go to the book stop and buy it with cash or something like that.
Now, if you do that, you go and you buy it, it flags in 20 times as many databases, and then you start getting advertisements like, hey, would you like to buy some fertilizer? Hey, would you like to buy...
Targeted ads for...
Ski masks.
You might
like
also
buy a ski mask.
You might also like...
Extremist Clippy pops up.
This.
Anarchy Vacation.
I see you bought Anarchist Cookbook. Would you also be interested...
It looks like you're trying to make a bomb.
Clippy.
Let me connect you to the nearest Clippy. FBI field office.
Well... Yeah, but like Barrett's point, you know, so if we were to just go ahead and sign on to this idea that it's not good, we're going to work to obliterate it from the internet. As soon as you even let it out that that's what you were trying to do, it would propagate 10 times faster. There would be more copies.
Yep.
For every one you struck down, 10 more would rise up in
Anarchist Cookbook. Barbara Streisand would be the new file extension.
Pretty much.
Well, and plus... The problem also with the internet is that it's not just in the U.S. So it just gets copied over to, you know.
Hold up. We don't control the internet. The entirety. Does our government know that? Someone should tell them.
Some of them definitely do not.
They have no idea.
They think it's a series of tubes.
But you know, somebody just puts it in Russia and in Christmas Islands. And...
Senator Feinstein and people like her, the internet is a thing that her aides use and like respond to. Constituent messages over. They have absolutely no clue or operating concept of what they're doing.
It's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like the opinions page of the paper.
No.
The Anarchist Cookbook is the Obamacare of anarchy manuals.
Thanks, Obama.
I don't even know what that means. But it sounds bad.
Well, and meanwhile, you know, you'd really like to get an interview with the senator where you, you know, pretend that you want to treat seriously her Anarchist Cookbook thing, and then ask her about Stingray. What she thinks about handing Barney Fife a device that can apparently do so much stuff with your cellular information that they don't want it to ever get into a court of law and be revealed what they know.
Senator Feinstein would actually be okay with that. Traditionally, she's been very pro law enforcement, pro NSA, pro CIA. And it's because I believe she's on the Defense Appropriations Committee or something like that. I'm now feeling idiotic that I don't know that off the top of my head.
She is.
Traditionally, yes, she has been very pro all forms of government-sponsored data collection. So I think that if you were to pose that question to her, that her answer would be that she is for it.
Now, the Stingray stuff, to give you an idea of what you can do, they're running something kind of similar to like OpenBTS, which is like an open source implementation of a base station transceiver. So it's pretty much like the same thing. It's like what people were doing kind of with femtocells. But so when a phone connects to it, it's not only can you see where they are, not only do you get GPS and triangulation information, you can actually pass configuration information down to the phone. So you can install software, you can
process all of their text messages.
Yeah, you can go through pretty much everything.
So it's unknown what you can do.
Yeah, because what happens is, you can do just about everything you can do on a phone. It's kind of known, because the issue is that the device manufacturers choose not to lock down different parts of the operating system updates, because it's very fine-grained control. A lot of things can go wrong. So instead, they just say, hey, if it's coming from the tower, if it's coming from AT&T or T-Mobile or Sprint, go ahead and trust that package.
It's assumed to be good.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
so,
because there's it's like the force. There's two sides to the force. There's two sides to every phone. There's the baseband side, which none of us have access to because it's wrapped in NDAs.
You've got to sign your life away just to even get a glimpse at it.
And then there's the front end, it's not user line, but there's the front end side with the operating system that we interact with. But yeah,
they get access to both, really.
Yes, they do. The baseband side of the phone, in addition to being relatively unknown outside of NDA'd circles, is theorized to have, in addition to trusting content that comes in, it's unaudited, and if there's any security vulnerabilities in it at all, which there are ultimately going to be, then even if the cell tower data transmitted to it wasn't trusted by default, the possibility of unknown exploits there are just all over the place. It's just a total wreck of a nightmare, and your phone is completely insecure, and you should probably all just throw your technology out and live in caves.
Just
honestly,
go move to the forest. I think it's not so much that they're hiding the capabilities and they're doing a lot of nefarious things. I think a lot of the sheriff's departments, they get this stuff from the companies that are making it. The companies that are making it know that if the public found out, they would freak out. So, you know, to protect their revenue stream, they wrap all this stuff in, you know, a series of non-disclosure agreements, you know, much like, you know, the Qualcomm does
with
the
stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so exactly. So I think it's more that. I don't think that the sheriff's offices know how to go in, or, you know, it's a lot of different agencies that are getting a hold of this and using it. I don't think they know how to go in and, you know, reboot phones and pack up malware and do all this nefarious stuff, but they do. It's a shotgun approach. If you're within like 2 miles of one of these devices and suddenly your call drops, something weird is going on and you can't really understand why, there's a good chance you could be, you know, locked onto a Stingray for a few minutes before they drop you and release you back in.
These things, I mean, they operate by, like you said, emulating cell towers, and your phone is by default as is the nature of a cell phone.
It hops to the next strongest signal. It thinks it's doing a pass off, and
Houston, if I remember correctly, Houston has either admitted to it or it's come out through FOIA requests that Houston does use this.
I have seen it. Now I do a little bit of spectrum analyzation at home, and I've got a lot of antennas up, and I've seen some weird stuff kind of come by, and I've seen T-Mobile towers that should not be moving.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
You know?
Well, there you go. Well, and the, you know, the other piece from that story where the FBI is telling law enforcement agencies to lie to courts.
That's the part that kills me. What's a
there
greater
the
good
part
argument,
where
right?
there's no First
that...
Amendment, whatever, national security, none of those things are a reason why a law enforcement officer should ever lie to a court.
Well, in their eyes, the argument is going to be a greater good argument. If there is the chance that, you know, that a case in litigation could cause information about this to be disclosed that could jeopardize tons of other cases or investigations in progress, then yeah, they want to drop that. And that was in the licensing agreement that the FBI makes local law enforcement agencies sign. That was all listed in there, the conditions under which they will ask local law enforcement to, like, delay FOIA requests, to delay responding in discovery requests for litigation, for the FBI to decide whether or not the case should be dropped
And what circumstance do they want them to come public with it? I mean, under no circumstances.
Under no circumstances. Right. So, yeah, they have to make that value judgment, right? Is it worth, you know, blowing case A in order to avoid cases B through, you know, Q?
But I think there's a way to do that with judicial oversight. You tell the judge, look, we have this. This is how we obtain the evidence. Show it to the judge. And if they decide, the judge can either say, yes, I think this is legal, we can admit it. Or if it doesn't, then the prosecution can say, hey, we don't want to divulge this, we're going to drop the case. But lying, that's a whole different game. Mm-hmm. That's perjury, actually.
It's,
that's worse.
Well, yeah. I don't know if it's
perjury. It's not perjury. There's something. I mean, you're definitely there's in contempt of court.
Yeah.
It's bad. You could get disbarred as an attorney.
It's a whole gigantic, terrible mess that I don't think anybody we were ever supposed to really know about, but it's, you know, this is the
And the other piece to it is just it's security through obscurity on top of security through obscurity. You know, the whole NDAing, the way the phones work, and then don't let anybody talk about how Stingray works. It, you know, I think it'll be real interesting to see what would happen if, say, Anonymous got a bee in their bonnet, or frankly, if John Oliver got a bee in his bonnet about this. I could see large numbers of smartasses setting up their own open source Stingray-style devices outside, say, the FBI or police stations, and letting them have a little taste of what
that's
it's
been,
like.
And that's not to you know, say, hey, that's everywhere, but that's been out for a couple of years. Like, if people really want to, you can go run your own cell phone tower. It's OpenBTS. You can get a software-defined radio like the Etis, like B210, for about $600-$700. Now, to get it to where you can get other phones camping on it, you need a very high quality clock source. That's about maybe like $300 more. So for like $1,000, you can build one of these from scratch, get the open source software, plug it into Asterix, and you can either do the legit thing and, you know, run your own mobile network, or you can go, you know, play cop for a little bit.
Well, what I think is going to happen, this is just my opinion, is that at some point, and I'm actually a little surprised it hasn't happened yet, what with the past 2 years of the shifting security landscape, is eventually you're going to get an annoyed, upset, disgruntled civil servant or someone who works in local law enforcement in some municipality that employs these things who has been fired or who has been made mad or, you know, something is going to happen. And one of these things is going to get leaked out.
Love
somebody's going to bring an operating manual out the door with them from one of these things.
Well, we know just with a lot of the NSA programs out there, there's already, you know, there's SIGINT, like, you know, capital SIGINT, which is signals intelligence. And there's a new, you know, kind of tongue in cheek. It's not that new. It's been around for a few years. They're calling it LoveInt, and it's where, you know, agents or people that have, you know, information to certain things may have a crush or an obsession or something, and they'll use this information to go see where they are. So it'd be very easy for someone in Houston to, you know, have an interest in someone and use this information to be like, oh, they were here at this time. Oh, they're here now.
Bites.
Groove, we can hear you.
Sorry.
Oh, I thought he was talking to us.
No, he's not talking to us. The argument is always that at some point you have to trust the watchers. You have to trust those who are in the position of authority and responsibility under the assumption that they are in that position because they are responsible enough to handle the responsibility of having the power to tap all the phone calls and listen to all the emails or whatever. People are people, man. I mean, ultimately, people are people and they do dumb people stuff. And if you're some random law enforcement officer in some municipality and you're doing a long stakeout and you've had a fight with your spouse and you're upset at them and you think they're out there cheating on you and, you know, you've got the ability to kind of flip two switches and pull up their phone records and listen into what their cell phone is doing at that exact moment. I mean, people are going to do it because that's how humans are. And that's why
for so long those kinds of systems were under things where, for instance, the police had to show a reason why they needed it and had a court order or a warrant where there was something you could go back to and show some transparency if you needed to, as opposed to this thing where, oh, well, it's about security, so no one can know.
At least, you know, a lot of the other stuff is going through
abuse.
It's going through, at least there's a FISA, which is, you know, although they've turned down 13 things in the last, you know, few decades, 30 years, at least there's a fake, I hate to say fake, at least there's a procedure in place to oversee that. With the Stingray stuff, there's absolutely nothing. You know, it goes directly from to the vendor to the, you know, sheriff's offices, the police forces, and then straight to
the police
to your cell
phone. are on record as falsifying may be too strong a word.
We've had a rash of
misstating the capabilities of the device when applying for warrants.
Mm-hmm. We have a call.
We do.
Yeah. That wants to chime in on the conversation.
And it looks relevant.
does look relevant. Groovehouse?
Yeah.
Who do we have?
First, we're going to speak with Fahad.
Fahad, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. What can we do for you?
All right. I wanted to ask about the home landline. I don't have one right now, but I just wanted to see if I can use an extra cell phone line that I have and try to use it as a fax machine somehow. Can I do that? Or
fax on a cell phone line? Like you somehow or another connect a fax where it would get dial tone to a fax machine?
Yeah, kind of use the cell phone line, the signal itself, and turn it to like a landline or a fax machine at the house.
Are you trying to get inbound fax? Are you trying to outbound fax? You want both?
I'm trying to get both. That would be better.
I would just do it digitally. I mean, there's so many, you know, email to fax services or just fax gateways or what have you.
I don't know of a way to like get dial tone to where you would get something that would answer like a phone. You know, if you call it with the fax machine, calls another fax machine, there's a handshake that happens. You have to have dial tone, and you have to get the fax signal over that. I don't know of a device that will hook up to a cell phone to do that. There are, Barrett mentioned,
e-fax.
There
is
are
a
lot of
one.
Online fax services, fax, which will give you a phone number so that they can send a fax to it. The only problem you're going to have, and then you can do it from a fax printer scanner to the internet. What do you got, Barrett?
Yeah, I was going to say, do you have is it an Android or is it Apple phone or what kind of phone?
Yeah, Android.
Go check out, there's an eFax mobile fax app that does pretty much the same thing. I mean, that's the thing. It's like what you're wanting to do is you want to take something that was digital in the first place and convert it down to analog and like go back and jump through all these backwards hoops of, you know, 20 years ago when you can just send the thing over an app. So check out the eFax app.
So that would
Android.
Just use the cell phone, the phone number, and just convert it into a fax.
No, it wouldn't even use the phone number of that. You would eFax.
It'd just be an app. Okay.
Well, when you go look at it on your computer, just go to efax.com. Oh. What happens is you sign up for an account and you get the ability to have a phone number that you can publicize as your fax number. And somebody can use a fax machine and dial that number, and it contacts the efax servers and receives the fax, and then it emails it to you.
Okay. One more thing was the...
The hard part will be getting your outbound faxes. Because you have to have a scanning device. You can either take a picture of
the
phone.
Take a picture of it, yeah.
And then fax it out that way. But I mean,
it's kind of slow.
Okay.
Pretend you're a spy. Just, you know, click, click, flip, click, click, flip.
So you're saying eFax is the one you recommend probably? So.
Well, I would look around.
It's one of many online digital fax services that allow you to receive inbound faxes. And you can then also upload a document that you've scanned on your scanner. And send it to a fax machine.
If you look at, like, you know, online or cloud-based fax, just go read a couple reviews, try out the top two, and just, you know, go with what you like. But definitely get one that has an Apple phone.
If I want to convert the cell phone into, I want to have a home base, like a home handset, is there a device where I can just connect the cell phone and turn it into a home handset to
act as a
landline?
There's a USB device that'll let you do that. I think that you can plug into the... into your phone that'll let you have a handset.
You can also go, I mean, if you want to go old school, you can go ThinkGeek used to sell actual rotary dial tone phones that have been converted to take SIM cards to where it's like an old phone that's now a cell phone.
Okay. So what is that called?
Well, the site was ThinkGeek.
Well, there's if you go to Amazon, there's a retro handset, and basically what it does is it plugs in to the... You know, like every phone has like the little headset with a microphone, right?
Yeah.
So what this does is it gives you a handset, like an old phone handset with a coiled wire and everything. You plug it into the headphone jack on your phone and you toggle it to talk just like you would, or you just pick it up and talk into it. Why?
Yeah, here's...
No. Why?
Why? Basically... My family at the house, they just want to have like a dedicated like handset, so I can have different handsets, like two or three handsets throughout the house, so it's not.
You can't do that with a
cell phone all the time.
No, you'd have to. It has to be connected directly to the cell
phone. Go check out. Do you have broadband at home? I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Check out, there are a couple services. One of them is Vonage or Vonage, depending on how you pronounce it. But what these are IP-based phones. And you can actually just get like a little box. So like, you know, like 15, 20 bucks.
Well, who's your provider?
Yeah.
What is it?
It works with all of them.
No.
Oh.
I have a serious question I'd like an answer to, Fahad.
Yeah. He said Comcast.
Is it Comcast?
Comcast. Yeah.
Comcast offers VoIP or voice over IP. It's an extra add-on service that you can get where you can plug a handset into the modem. And
I'm aware of. I was just trying to use an extra cell phone line that I had on the family plan. It's just basically not being used. So I was trying to see if I could just put it to some use.
There's no good way. Just put it on the kitchen counter and whoever wants to use it, grab it. Yeah. Piping it into a home landline is just kind of tough.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, good luck, sir. Thanks for the call.
Thanks.
So it was only peripherally about cell phones.
I'm going to have to just start doing a lot better screening.
Okay.
I thought he was on topic and then... Yeah, it turned into a freaking...
The NSA was listening in. That totally puts us on topic.
Right. Hey,
what's the next
topic? And we have a call from Officer Jones. He said that extra line has been getting used and that they are currently on... No, I'm kidding.
I see what you did
using
there.
Stingray, he's installed some VoIP software on the device and a fax
I think
app.
The idea of trying to, you know, if you're going to go the extra step of getting rid of your landline, then you need to go the additional steps of using the digital solutions that are out there. I mean, the idea of, I mean, a cell phone is not going to give you, like, you know, your home phone on a landline, the whole idea of a landline is you have twisted pair that comes in and connects up all these jacks in your house so you can plug a handset in and they can all share that one line. So I don't know of a device that will do that for a cell phone, but the idea of a cell phone, either way, only one person can use it at a time. Like Barrett said, stick the phone on a charger on the kitchen counter. If somebody needs... I mean, what's the difference of holding a cell phone to your head as opposed to an old-timey handset?
I think you should get Twisted Pair run in, get a T1 set up, get Asterisk installed.
Mux out your own phone lines.
Get handsets in every room and give every member of your family
every,
a three-number extension.
The telephone.
No.
It should be the telecom of things.
Run open BTS, and then you can have all your own cell phones. Then you just get the cell phone, and then you've got to figure out a way to fax. So hold. Okay.
And we're back to square
one.
You have to go get some crimping tools, get some RG11 heads, cables, and make some ports to tie into your T1 line. I guess you'd need some more.
Oh, come on!
There.
If you want to go old school, you gotta be doing your own punch downs.
Get a punch down block.
Block,
a punch tool.
Just go no. old school. All the way
on a different one. I don't know if you've ever used like a SIP phone. At one point I had a job where I was ending, you know, I had put in my notice and I'd been offered another job, another place. And just because of the needs of the two jobs, there was overlap where I basically went and started the new job and worked there a couple weeks and needed to be available at the old job. And I would come back and do the last week and all that. And the thing was, they had SIP phones, and so I basically brought my desk phone from my old job and stuck it on the network at my new job, and I could be called like I was an extension of my, you know, in the office, just like I had left. There were people who didn't realize I wasn't there because they could message me or call me on my extension, and I could help them.
Nice.
I always thought that was pretty cool.
And it depending upon the provider. It can be super high quality too. We use those at ours. All the Ars Technica staff, we all have SIP phones on our desk. I think we use OnSIP for the provider. I think that's right. But yeah, they all use HD voice. So you pick up so you call each other on this, and it sounds like it's like radio quality. It's not like talking on a phone. It's like everything sounds awesome. You get really spoiled really quickly.
Yeah, well, you could go to a hotel and you just bring your phone with you. You know, stick it in your suitcase and plug it in.
Good, actually.
If you had an Ethernet drop, you could do it.
We have a you can just go to their website and like log into your extension and get calls. I could do that right now if I wanted to.
We do it with Cisco Makes Packages where you use soft phones, which is pretty nice. Yeah, you just one click and you can take calls from your mic and speaker.
And it works, sort of. And it kind of almost works most of the time.
Half the time, it works all the time.
There you go. Yes, sir.
All right.
So, well, anybody interested in some Apple rumorings?
Absolutely.
We've got a few minutes before we have to break. Yeah.
The biggest one that's around is there's very high likelihood that a new Apple TV box will be out in June or announced in June, you know, for the Worldwide Developers Conference. The big rumor that's out is that one thing that won't be happening on a feature is that the new Apple TV won't support 4K output, which is sort of interesting. You know, the current Apple TV box is about 3 years old and really way past due for an upgrade. But the rumor is that no 4K primarily because 4K is far from a mainstream feature right now. It's just that you get more and more places are starting to offer it, and I guess this is Apple calculating that 4K video, that the extra costs on the hardware aren't going to be worth it. So, you know, if you're a numbers person where, oh, no, you have to have 4K, you know, I guess I have to wonder how many people have 4K televisions.
Probably not
yet.
A lot. I think the current gen Apple TV, I should have looked this up before I opened my mouth. I think it uses a Pentium M, and I think it's got an integrated GPU in it, but I don't know how good it is at 4K decoding. So, I mean, maybe it's just a question of not wanting to change their SoC out and having to add in a whole new 4K decode, something that has a 4K decode.
Well, actually, the Apple TV has an Apple A5 SoC system on chip.
Well, see, that's why I should have looked before I opened my stupid mouth. I just wanted
and it'll
to,
do,
just
well,
to
the thing
on
is
the
it,
air
it
and
tops
talk.
Out at 1080p, and I'm guessing apparently the Apple A8 would run circles around it, but I'm guessing it wouldn't run circles enough to do 4K.
Maybe. Who knows?
Although apparently now, if you have a modern, you know, a recent MacBook Pro, especially the Retina display MacBook Pros, that they'll drive 4K monitors at 60 hertz if you get it. And
yes, that is true.
They have enough graphics horsepower to do that.
That is correct. I know the 5K iMac that I tested does. It does that without any problems. But that's a pretty hefty piece of hardware.
And let's see, other stuff. You know, we have to mention it. Well, we can keep it short. But Apple Watch, you know, obviously the day is coming. The 10th is, I believe, the day that that it happens. One thing is that if you make a reservation to get an Apple Watch, it's one Apple Watch reservation at a time for in-store pickup, apparently.
Yes, and I believe it's going to be...
Sources confirmed that customers will be limited to one Apple Watch each through Apple's reserve and pickup service.
And they're going to do like Apple decides to do with some of their new products. They're going to do the thing where it goes on sale for pre-order, not at a normal human being time, but at midnight Pacific, I believe. So you'll be up here in Central Time, you'll be up at 2 a.m. frantically hitting F5 over and over and over again on the store page so you can get it in the first batch.
Are they going to enforce one? So is it, well, it's not one per customer, it's just one per visit. So you could get some mustaches, some hats, some scarves, and go in multiple times.
You can't just walk in and buy it.
You can make multiple. Yeah, but couldn't you make multiple reservations?
Maybe you could, yeah. Maybe they're going to gate it by IP address to prevent.
Apple reserves the right to refuse, limit, or cancel a reservation if they determine a customer has provided misleading or fraudulent information.
There you go.
So if Barrett,
so you can't do the Peter Griffin mustache.
Barrett and Ferret and Darrett all want to get watches. They cannot.
I wasn't going to get one anyway.
Jay and Hay and okay.
Hey.
Hey!
Right. Hey!
If we do pull off this heist, though, I'm making up the names. That's just so
yeah,
we're
better.
All right, we gotta go. that music is telling us we gotta take a short break, we're gonna take a short break and be right back after these important messages. You're listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
Lovely.
And he's
Groove House.
The 2015 Sounds of Texas Music Series is about to begin. KPFT Houston is proud to help present three outstanding concerts at the Crichton Theater in downtown Conroe with legendary musicians from Texas and beyond. Saturday, March 21st, one of Texas's finest singer-songwriter couples, Kelly Willis and Bruce Robison, will take the stage at the Crichton Theater. Rising star John Fulbright will also perform a complete set. Saturday, May 9th, three great performers will share the stage in an unforgettable evening featuring legendary Texas rocker Joe Ely, soulful songstress Ruthie Foster, and gifted storyteller Paul Thorne. The series finishes Saturday, June 6th, with the terrific double bill of Uncle Lucius and beloved Texas singer-songwriter Ray Wiley Hubbard. For season tickets, call 936-441-7469, extension 201. Visit soundsoftexasmusicseries.com for more details. Don't miss the Sounds of Texas Music Series at the Crichton Theater in downtown Conroe, presented by the Friends of Conroe, a Montgomery County nonprofit organization, and KPFT Houston.
KPFT recientemente ha finalizado su campaña de membresías que tuvo al aire. Si usted fue uno de los muchos radioescuchas quienes se unieron a esta campaña, muchas gracias. Antes de que lo sepa, su sobre de membresía llegará por correo. No olvide mandar su donación. El gran sentimiento que usted obtiene cuando apoya KPFT es mejor una vez que usted haya colocado su cheque en el correo. Y si usted perdió la oportunidad de unirse y apoyar las noticias, la música u otra gran programación que usted escucha cada día, aún hay tiempo. Únase por vía internet visitando la página www.kpft.org y haga su parte. Gracias una vez más por apoyar a la radio de la comunidad. Esta es libre de comerciales, patrocinada por Radio Escuchas, Radio Pacífica, KPFT, Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, and we now return you to Technology Bites.
This is the show. Welcome to the show.
Technology.
Technology. Oh, man, that reminds me. I found that I still have all those old promos that Flick had made.
Did they start off
We should just play them. Those were fun.
I need
to I think I've still got all of them somewhere.
I had them.
You could play them, and we wouldn't have to talk. You could just play promos for like 2 hours.
I think I only made seven, although there were a couple of anniversary shows.
But do we have them that are still applicable? Well, yeah, we've got probably half of those are still probably applicable to our time slot, huh?
Yeah, I think there might have only been one or two that was the wrong time now. I think most of them are correct.
I'm trying to remember what folder I uploaded them to.
Do they say who's on the show? Because that would definitely throw it off.
We can just do like a bad dub job over that and fix it right up.
No, mostly because most of the core group that was on the air was stable. So I know it mentions Jay and Peter. Every once in a while it mentions me. Of course, part of it, I'm talking. And then it mentions Barrett. And I can't remember if I had any that mentioned Group House or not. No.
Am I in there?
Well, that's wishful thinking.
See
there.
The future.
We'd add in a, and the rest.
That would be a three-hour tour. It's only a two-hour tour now, but thank goodness Lee's here. Let me see if I got a... I'm downloading them. I had stuck them on the web server, and I was looking around on FTP looking for something else and realized that I had these stored on there, and I hadn't. These things they date back to
1942
to 2008, and this is like the
really.
First...
I think the first one I did was earlier than that. I think the first one I did was 2002 or 2003.
Let me see.
Oh, that's like the sixth or seventh one.
Al-Qaeda, McDonald's, Enron, the U.S. government. KPFT, big business. Dick Cheney, Starbucks, your mom. What's the thread that ties all of these together? Technology. We need a serious show for these serious times. Technology Bites. Technology Bites, 8 to 10 p.m. Wednesdays here on KPFT 90.1 FM. Technology Bites. We're serious. Serious. No, really, really. Serious. Okay, you can stop the music now.
Did we pay Danny Elfman for that?
But we were serious about that serious stuff. Seriously. Especially Jay.
Danny Elfman can't be serious.
That was actually, that was a Batman thing.
This is Flicked with Technology Bites. Why should you listen to Technology Bites? One word. Celebrities.
Hello, guys. Listen to Adam Smasher. That's Adam Smasher.
Okay, well, sort of celebrities, kind of.
They can't give me a freaking billboard, you know?
Well, at least they're entertaining, right?
Well, you know, I only use my computer for porn. I went to Catholic school, so I was molested by priests many years ago.
Okay, well, they bring in the kind of listeners KPFT wants.
I had somebody at the one of the ghetto stations wanted to kick my ass. I think he's forming a posse as we speak.
Huh. Okay, well, maybe forget about the celebrities thing.
Once again, listen to Adam Smith.
Shut up! Okay, look, forget the celebrity thing. Listen to Technology Bites because you can laugh at some geeks trying pathetically to answer callers' computer questions. Sometimes they're even right. It's all waiting for you, 8 to 10 p.m. Wednesdays here on KPFT 90.1 FM.
Celebrities.
Celebrities?
Oh, I just got an email. Dianne Feinstein wants that removed from the internet.
That's a callback.
Oh.
God, remember the time in 2008 or 2007 when Adam Smasher called into the show?
Who was that guy?
He was a DJ on...
104.
I forgot. How long have you lived in
but
this city?
What happened was he was... He had put out a thing where he was giving some tickets away to some show, and the deal was that people had to call and get his name mentioned on other radio stations in Houston or something. So somebody called us, our show, and they explained this to us. So then we called Adam Smasher and talked to him and had him on, like, brought him onto the show. And, yeah, he said a bunch of stupid thing. So then, yeah, I made this promo that we had celebrities on our show
that's
based on the interview that we had with him.
That's terrible. That's not great at all.
That made his career, though, didn't it? Didn't we kind of boost him to start?
Yeah, that appearance on Technology Bites clearly was transformed his early career into his later career.
We are star makers.
We are.
I like the... those were okay. I like the monster truck one. That,
I
like
Sunday,
that one.
Someday.
Yeah.
I like the Yamame one.
Yeah. Pick
Wednesday.
Up, don't use Technology Bites to pick up chicks.
Yeah.
Technology Bites. If you crave hard pounding bone crushing computer problems, then tune in Wednesdays. From 8 until 10 p.m. Listen to Jay and Peter perform death defying talk radio support before your very ears. Technology Bites. How can we make it even better? How about everyone gets it? Yes, you heard that right. We must be crazy. That's Wednesdays, 8 to 10 p.m. KPFT 91.1 FM. Be there and be square.
Yeah, I like that one.
Flicted does all the voice work in these.
Yes, he does.
So for the listeners that don't know, yeah.
Yeah, I never had anybody else ever do a voice.
That's kind of how we got connected to Flicted.
He made a promo for the show early on.
He made some artwork.
Shirts.
Some shirt artwork.
Yeah, when y'all were trying to do your shirts. I submitted some shirt ideas, which were mostly, the text and the puns about it more than the shirts, because it was pretty simple designs. But then you had Jay said, hey, that's pretty cool, like, why don't you come down to the station sometime
if
you want
to.
We'll
lock you in this booth.
You've got
20
t-shirt skills. That translates into radio skills.
And so I came down, like, well, I'm not really sure. I used to do college radio, so that'd be cool to just see the station and everything.
Get in the booth and stay there.
But, yeah, I don't really know what I'm going to talk about or anything. And
well, you would call into the show too, and you hung out on IRC, and
I hung
out
on
funny.
IRC.
You were very funny. Obviously, it's paid off in spades.
Clearly, turned into this high paid.
Now I'm a celebrity.
Peter Hughes of Technology Bites would like to give you this friendly reminder: Technology Bites should not be used to quote unquote pick up chicks.
Hey, baby, you come around here? I like you anyway. Hey, baby, how's it going? My name's Flicted. Anyway, now that we've gotten the formalities out of the way, I got this little show. Well, radio show, that is. Yeah, 8 to 10 p.m. Wednesdays on 90.1 KPFT. I'm kind of like the star and everything, but hey, you should check it out. You know, you're not doing anything. Yeah, it's called Technology Bites. Hey, what's wrong? Where are you going? At 8 to 10 p.m. It's a call-in show. Yamame! Wednesdays, KPFT 90.1. Technology Bites! Oh, man.
That's awesome.
That's the good one. They're all good. Remember when you were funny? All right, Peter Hughes. What do we got next? I was going to go back to the show prep site.
Responsive HTML5 show prep site.
I guess it depends. Do we want to? I guess the Apple Watch reviews have started to trickle out. I don't know.
It's a sore spot for Lee, though.
Why is that?
Well, since, I guess I'll then we'll go full meta on it and just give you the headline from Gizmodo. The Apple Watch meta review, not perfect, but full of potential. So if you already were like so totally psyched about having your Apple Watch, go right ahead. You'll probably be happy. If you were on the fence, probably wait and see what people say. And if you didn't like it in the first place, well, you can go find some reviews that will reinforce that opinion too.
I've read a lot of comparisons to the first gen iPhone with how things are working out. And that seems pretty logical. Although, to me at least, the difference between the Apple Watch and the first gen iPhone is that in 2007, when the iPhone was being released, I guess it was announced in late 2006 or early 2007. I guess it was announced in early 2007 and then launched in June. But if you haven't, I mean, you forget how bad cell phones were, especially cell phones that tried to be anything other than basic cell phones. Smartphone functionality, like you might have had like your Trio or something and or a Palm Pilot. But, I mean, smartphones were terrible. And the difference
here, I had a Razor.
Yeah, I did too, actually. And the difference is that smartwatches today really aren't all that great as a category, but watches as a category are pretty well, we got that pretty well locked up. And so, you know, the question is like, what do you need a smartwatch to do? You know, we've already revolutionized the little portable computer thing, and that's the smartphone that everybody carries in their pockets. So do you really need a device on your wrist that is 90% of what it does requires a phone anyway, and it's mostly useless except as a basic watch if it doesn't have a phone paired to it? And do you need this thing to be mirroring notifications from your phone up onto your wrist? You know, I don't really know. I don't think that the time is yet right. I'm sure Apple's going to sell a million, billion of them and make a hillion, bajillion dollars. But until these things don't require a phone to be tethered to them, I don't think they're going to be, you know, totally self-sustaining and they're going to totally take off yet. You know, and plus, there's that really crazy thing about how, like, this, the Apple Watch in particular runs the pricing gamut from between $349, I think, or $379, I forget what the lowest price is, all the way up to the crazy, you know, $10, $12, $15, $17,000 ones. You know, a $17,000 watch isn't necessarily unheard of. You can get those from fine watch manufacturers anywhere. But a $17,000 watch
is worth $17,000.
Is an heirloom that you're going to probably keep in your family for generations and hand down to people, and it will continue working for decades and decades and decades with, you know, minor repairs and stuff if it's a fine watch. A battery-powered Apple Watch with its own little SoC in it, even if it's encased in a $17,000 rose gold, you know, enclosure with a fine leather band, is not something that in 40 years your grandchildren are going to have.
You know, it's, to me, that's kind of like the people who looked at the pricing on the apps in the App Store and picked the most expensive price you could possibly pay for an app, and then the app just said, I paid whatever amount of money for this app.
I am rich app.
Yeah, that's pretty much what that most expensive Apple Watch is.
Well, you know, I mean, okay, so there's clearly a market there of people who, even if they're not watch aficionados, there's clearly a moneyed market where people are willing to pay $10,000+ for an Apple phone or for an Apple Watch. So they're taking advantage of that. I totally get it, right? Even if they, I don't know what their margin is on something like that, but the margin has got to be just absolutely just off the charts insane. And I'm sure if they sell one of them, they've made enough money to have made a whole bunch of them, and they'll sell them, and it's not a problem. So good for them. But it's just, I don't know, man. It's just crazy that you would spend something like that without getting the return that you would get from another non-smartwatch timepiece that cost about the same amount of money.
Yeah, I think overall the Apple Watch, what's going to happen is ultimately it may grow into something that makes its own category, kind of like the iPhone. But right now, if the iPhone is kind of an integrated part of your daily life and you want to make it even sort of more smoothly integrated where you don't have to pull your phone out of your pocket and that kind of stuff, then the Apple Watch could do something for you. But as far as it like really changing things for you, if you're not already kind of heavy into the Apple phone and using it a lot, I don't know that it'll make that big a difference. And the best advice I saw is, unless you're going for sort of the cheaper end of it, you may want to wait for another generation before you.
Well, I don't mind paying $350 or $379, whatever the entry is. I know it's under $400. I think it's $379. I don't mind.
I think the $350 one is the smaller one, which is intended for women.
Okay,
but
whatever the low end is, I don't mind paying that much for a gadget that I'm going to keep for 2 or 3 years. That doesn't really bother me. That's kind of the price of admittance to be an alpha tech geek these days. Is you got to buy all the things, right? So no biggie there. But yeah, it's going to be. You can't swap the SoC out like you could swap out the motion in a fine watch. So you can't swap the radio out. I don't remember if they said the battery's replaceable or not, but I mean this is a device with a limited operational lifetime. It is what it is.
I can't see tech as an heirloom unless it's like,
an Apple II.
Well, the sad thing is, probably if you bought the Apple Watch, even maybe the expensive one, and you never used it, you kept it in the original packaging and all that stuff, and waited a while. I know that like the original iPhones in that packaging have sold for more than they sold for originally.
Well, can't do anything with them.
but the sad part is, buying it and not using it at all is just kind of. It's not a good investment.
Well, I won't begrudge anybody their gadgets. I like so many other people. I was one of those idiots waiting in line for 6 hours in 2007 to buy a first gen iPhone, and it was worth the wait. But still, I don't know. I'm just not sold on the smartwatch concept, not yet. And from what the early reviews are saying, they're saying that there's a substantial learning curve. You need to kind of take time, several days worth of time. And get used to it. And that's why I think why Apple is making the smart move and only selling them with like a concierge appointment so you can, have it demoed to you. And it requires a little bit to grok. It's not something you're just going to strap on and go. But, on the other side of that, every review that I've read has said that it's a high quality gadget. The physical feel of it is really nice. And, I don't know, I wouldn't mind trying one out, but it's still just I'm just not sold yet, sir. So if we're trying buying or frying that, I would try.
If you were given the opportunity.
If I was given the opportunity, which I have not yet been. But maybe one day.
Perhaps your feelings on the phone might be different had you had the opportunity to experience it in person.
No, generally I just hate all new things and crap on basically everything I'm given no matter what.
Or fly it into a tree
or just mercilessly dog on it.
Well, there's got to be at least some promise for it because you said it's like the first generation iPhone as opposed to the first generation Newton.
Yeah, that's true. And you know what? Like I said, they're going to sell a bajillion squintillion of them. There's absolutely no danger here. They're not going to make a ton of money, and good for them.
The interesting part is that they're getting people to spend the equivalent of buying a whole nother iPhone,
on a device that requires an iPhone.
It has to pair up with one. So you've already got one, and then you're spending the amount, because if you get any of the fancy bands, if you do anything but the most basic, it gets up to around $700 really quick.
You blow a grand pretty quick. If you're a fan of a nice band and you like to, have this certain set of finishes and you want the sapphire glass, you'll hit that $1,000 mark without too much trouble. Speaking of hitting marks real fast, I see the next thing up on the list in the Try Buy or Fry is the Tesla Model S. And that's something else I can talk about at length.
It's not the Tesla still hasn't said what their new thing that ain't a car is, but they did raise the standard on their base sedan. The Tesla Model S 70D is all-wheel drive instead of rear-wheel drive, and they bumped the price up about $5,000 over the low end of the Tesla Model S line, but they put that second motor at the front of the vehicle and a bigger battery pack that bumps it up to an EPA rate, the range up to an EPA rated 240 miles. The other thing that's not as obvious with the, other than adding the front wheels driving, is that on the Model 60, if you wanted to be able to use the Tesla, you know, their fancy charge stations, supercharging, you had to pay extra on the Model S 60, where this new one, part of your $5,000 gets you that you all automatically have access to the supercharging.
It's actually interesting.
Go ahead. 0 to 60 in 5.2 seconds.
No, I'm not a car person, but for that much horsepower, it's got like 500 plus horsepower.
No.
Isn't
this one is 329 horsepower.
Okay,
rated.
Isn't that kind of slow?
No,
the 70D is 514 horsepower.
Yeah, well, for 5.2 seconds for a car that weighs as much as it does with the batteries in it, because remember, this is a big sedan-sized monster, and 5.2 seconds, 329 horsepower.
It's also it's an electric.
Well, here we go. Yeah, combined 514 horsepower.
It's an electric motor.
Which one are you looking at?
70D, 514 horsepower combined,
okay,
top speed of 140 miles an hour, 0 to 60 is 5.2 seconds.
Well, I mean,
Since it's an electric motor, the power band's a little different.
I've driven most of the Tesla line at one point or another. I drove the P85D Plus, or the P85 Plus last year. I've driven the 85D and the P85D this year. And yet, the fact that the motors are electric and have no power band, or rather, their power band is linear. They don't come on cam because there are no cams. There's a single reduction gear, and that's the only transmission that there is. And it's when you mash the accelerator down, if you're at a standstill, you get the maximum amount of torque that the engine is capable of delivering. And it does follow a curve. In fact, the top speed of the cars is limited not by aerodynamics or anything. It's limited by the actual turn speed of the electric motor, and if they'd have to re-gear it to go faster. And it does reduce torque as you get going faster and faster. But, I mean, honestly, driving in, I just up in Austin in October is when I drove the P85D, which is the dual drive performance crazy model with 691 horsepower.
Mode.
Yeah, with the insane mode button on, and it really does have a button on the dash where you can flip between sport and insane acceleration. And this one does 3.1 seconds for 0 to 60, and you can find videos on YouTube of a guy who has purchased one and also has a lot of exotics, and he set up a street race between it and his Lamborghini Gallardo. And for the majority of the race, up until about 100 miles an hour, the Tesla is ahead of the Lamborghini. It just pulls like a monster truck. And it is so ridiculously, neck-snappingly fast. It's like teleporting. So anyway, yeah, they've swapped out the lower end with this new uprated battery. And I was going to say, interestingly enough, if you go to their website and look at the current car lineup, they're all dual motor. It only took less than a year, I guess, from when they announced the dual motor one to where everything now, the 70D, the 85D, and the PD5D, they're all dual motor. Now, they still sell a rear wheel drive 85 version, but you have to like click down into the options to find it. Everything is all wheel drive, super fast. Unfortunately, still costs a little bit to get into one. They kind of do what they can to hide the true cost. Like the top number they display when you go look to see how much these things cost has federal tax credit and gas estimated gas savings and incentives and stuff all factored into it. But cash money to get into the entry level Tesla with entry level options, which you wouldn't want because all the cool self driving stuff isn't turned on unless you pay extra for it. You're pre tax, no tax, no title, no license. So not turnkey price, starts at $75,000 and
yes,
goes up.
Yes, it has keyless entry and that the autopilot hardware is included, although you have to get this. There's a software update that it
pay.
Needs.
And if you pay, if you buy it, it's the autopilot convenience feature package, it looks like. It's $2,500 if you buy it with the car. But if you decide to activate it later, it's $3,000. So activate it now. And if you go in here and go kind of crazy and spec one of these things out with all the every option, the nicest paint and the big 21-inch wheels and the super fast stuff and all the options and everything, it comes out to about $130,000.
That's even more than the Roadsters were.
Try, buy, or fry.
Well.
Who's paying?
Yeah, who's paying for it? Try.
Comes with a free Apple Watch.
Absolutely try one if you have the chance. I mean, and you can go test drive them. Go down to the store in the gallery and test drive all day long. Do it because it's a hell of an experience. But, you know, unless you can, unless you are the type of person who doesn't mind dropping six figures on a car, I don't think we can say buy. I mean, unless, like, if it's all three of us together combining our incomes and superpowers and the guys in the booth. And then, yeah, we all like timeshare a Tesla.
You remember that episode of The Simpsons when the three of them bought the Radioactive Man number one comic book?
And they had to share.
And they had to share it.
Didn't they end up destroying the Radioactive Man comic book?
They sure did.
What are you saying, Jay? You're saying
that would never happen to us.
Barrett would drive our Tesla into a bridge abutment?
That would never happen to me. That's not...
Well, first of all, you never enter into a timeshare with Barrett when it comes to technology or mechanical stuff.
Never get into a land war in Asia.
As long as,
never,
but only as, long as I get the technology first. I don't think that word means what you think it means.
Functionality?
I've built up an immunity to functionality over the past 2 years.
Well, more in our budget range, although we'll see if it's something that people
like
want
saying,
to try by.
I just like saying $130,000.
I was going to ask you if you attended a Columbia School of Broadcasting crash
yes,
course
just
over, the
over the last week. I've learned how to speak in a lower register, especially when announcing dramatic things. Continue,
you know,
Peter.
But if you really wanted to say it was expensive, you could have said that it costs as much as 8 Apple watches.
It costs as much as 8 Apple watches.
eight of the $17,000 Apple watches.
$17,000 Apple watches.
The Intel Compute Stick. Boy, they really know how to come up with snappy names, don't they? It's a $150 dongle that can turn anything with an HDMI port into a full-fledged Windows computer. This is not to be confused with the one last week that was a dongle, a $100 dongle that could turn anything with an HDMI port into a Chrome OS computer.
Gosh, what
made a big splash at CES 2015, and now it is for real. They have pre-orders at Amazon and Newegg. It's got a quad-core 1.33 gigahertz Intel Atom with 2 gigs of RAM and 32 gigs of solid-state storage. That one is $180, and that's the that's the better version, apparently, that you get at Amazon. There is one that's a 1 gig of RAM, 8 gig of storage Linux version for $130 for cheaper. And Newegg actually looks like the best price for the kind of top of the line of the stick.
You know, so, I like these little things. These are the kind of gadgets that, I mean, not just the Intel one, all these little computers on a stick things. These are the kind of gadgets where, like, you want to take them back in time, like, 10 years and just blow your mind from 10 years ago. Like, check
the
this
problem
out.
Is they all are HDMI, and so you'd be looking.
You have to bring a TV with you. Like, hold on, let me set this
I'm
up.
I'm gonna blow your mind. Just give me a couple hours.
Give me
here.
A minute. Hold on.
Do you have an HDMI cable?
Yeah. I forgot the HDMI to DVI converter.
Hold on, let me travel
in the future
in time for a minute. Real quick. I'll be right back.
I totally got on the wrong timeline. Did I bring my cable yet? No, that was another timeline.
Kill Hitler. Check HDMI. Oh, HDMI.
Feel like in Bill and Ted, remember the cable. And the cable drops down in front of you, because if you have a time machine, then just like later when you're done with the demo, you have to remember to go back in time to then and drop the cable off and then go back. So you wouldn't really have to go back forward in time then, as long as you did it later to the same time, like in Bill and Ted.
Paradox.
Speaking of time travel, Back to the Future 4 has been greenlit.
Really?
I haven't read any details of what the storyline is supposed to be, but
does it involve a time machine?
I'm sure
it's a fair bet.
And if it was a little over a week ago, I would doubt the report, but I guess it's late enough that it can't be like some kind of April Fool's.
Unless thing. I read an old...
Uh-oh. Are you falsing us,
they
Jay?
Everyone seems a little old to go and do that unless they brought in some new characters. The HDMI stick, the thing that worries me about this...
Oh, never mind. It was April Fool's.
Yeah. I was about to say, people are getting kind of long in the beard and the hair and the... the tooth and everything. The Linux, so far, everything I've seen so far has always been, you know, kind of Linux-based, whether it's, you know, Chromebook or whether it's Android or whether it's whatever. It's a Linux kernel at its heart. And that does really well on, you know, not that great of hardware. On hardware without great specs, it does pretty good with, you know, swapping out memory. Yep. So I'd be curious to see, because, again, I don't think they're going to somehow miraculously cram in $500 worth of hardware into a $150 stick.
It'd be a neat trick.
It would be a neat trick. I'm curious to see what the Windows experience would be. Like,
maybe,
you know,
it's
how laggy it would be if it would, you know, I don't know. I'm curious.
What
says it's a full version, right?
What was the, Peter, if you happen to have the specs, what's the SoC that they're using?
It's 1.33 gigahertz or 1.21 gigawatt. Go to the back future reference. No, 1.33 gigahertz Intel Atom.
Z3.
You know, they haven't been compute stick size, but they've been making little mini all-in-one PCs with Atom processors in them for forever, and they've been selling them as
like
HTPCs.
The MacBook Air.
Well,
the first MacBook Air had an Atom processor in it.
Did it?
Pretty sure.
Oh, I thought it had like a Centrino or something dumb.
Atom Smasher.
I think it was an Atom. I think.
I don't know. I don't know about that. But I mean, you can for years to go buy little HTPC boxes. I've used them for closet servers that are HTPC type computers with Atoms and little integrated GPU and you know, kind of garbagey specs, but that do okay because of the you know, the sophistication of the SoC's got all these hardware decoding tricks and stuff in it that it does. I don't know. I think it'd be fine in Windows. I mean, you wouldn't want to be running, you know, massive analytics software or whatever, but if it's, you know, this thing you're going to plug in and do some web browsing on, probably fine.
So it'll be interesting to see how that moves forward. I could see where there could be a real opening for this in the education market, just like when we talked about the Chrome one, you know, where each kid could end up carrying around their own copy and you just have the monitors and keyboards at each desk for in the computer lab. So you're not having to support although the Windows thing, that may be a nightmare if you're supporting all those kids on Windows as opposed to something lighter like Chrome OS.
You're saying they might break Windows? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, since you can do that just by using it, if just depending on how long you're talking about and how many people.
That's not fair. Windows is a perfectly stick. I'm sorry I couldn't finish that without laughing.
Yes, you used up all your straight face last week for April Fool's, right?
I did.
It looks like the first, I was afflicted on this, but it looks like the first gen of MacBook Air actually used a Core 2 Duo.
Huh.
Is that
must
correct?
Must have been a ULV one. But that makes sense because that was, jeez, when was that, 2008?
Yeah, 4 megs on-chip L2 cache.
2008
yeah, 1.8 gigs. That was 2008.
2008.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's the right time.
Early 2008.
That is the right time. That thing was garbagey, too. I mean, it looked sharp, but it was basically like the slowest computer that they ever made, ever.
Yeah, but it was a different reason for it. It was, you know, super thin. Flicted had
it was
one of the first generations,
thin.
And I was always envious.
Did you have, Flicted, did you have the one with the 5400 RPM hard drive, or did you have the SSD, the early SSD they had?
No, I had the one that was the physical spinning quarter-sized hard drive.
Oh, that's right. Oh, that's right. They had a little micro drive.
Panasonic, whoever made it.
It was like the iPod hard drive.
Yeah, it wasn't very fast.
Yeah, well, now they're fast.
But it
now
was,
see,
it was
that,
okay.
The difference between that and the watches, they were selling them right away, and so people went nuts and bought them and didn't think about it, where the watch, since they announced it last fall, people had plenty of time to, like, decide what makes sense instead of, like, hitting the reality distortion field and just, I gotta have it. It's so thin. It was in a manila envelope kind of thing.
That was nice, though, because it was really light. And it functioned, I mean, for what I needed it to do.
Sure.
Well, and look how influential, I mean, how everybody's got a thin laptop similar to the Air.
It turned into a class. It turned into Ultrabooks, and now everybody's got one. In fact, with some of the new ones that are coming out, frankly, like Dell's XPS 13 and a couple of the other ones that look really, really nice, they actually are starting to make the MacBook Air look positively dated. They've got these beautiful thin bezels and
blasphemy.
Carbon fiber. No, seriously, they're getting super nice.
So show me a picture.
What? All right, hold on.
Yeah, that's one of the, while he's fine, he's looking that up. That's one of the things that's sort of interesting. I don't know if it's a if it's a, you know, post Steve Jobs thing, but Apple seems to have more stuff that's got potential but isn't necessarily quite there unless you're really into it type devices is what they've been releasing lately. You know, case in point, the Apple Watch, and then also the Retina, the MacBook, the Retina display MacBook, the 12-inch. Both things that seem to be that the most sensible thought is to wait for the second generation when they maybe make it more solid. Except yes. The PC world seems to have caught up on the MacBook Air, and so there's less time for Apple to do that kind of try and change things and innovate and have time to be, I guess, sell to the early adopters and then set up the more solid second gen, unlike what they had before.
Yes.
Well, Lee showed me a picture of a Dell XPS 13, and it looks kind of attractive.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a... Let me scroll back up to it. Ah! It's...
Oh, wait, that's Goatsy. I'm just kidding.
Ah, no! Bleach! I bleach! No, it's a nice little...
It's a slash pony.
It's a nice little Ultrabook. I mean, you know, you've got to dig down into the dregs at this point, honestly, to find an OEM that isn't making a nice-looking Ultrabook Acer. You've got to really get down there before you can find one that isn't, you know, quality-looking. And that's good. I mean, that's one of the side effects of having an OEM like Apple absolutely destroy and reshape a market. And they've done it with, you know, they did it with smartphones. Everything is, you know, I don't think anybody is... Well, maybe some of the hardcore Android people get angry, but everything is an iPhone. They're all iPhones, even though Android has nothing to do. I mean, they're all patterned after the original iPhone. Tablets, Apple created a tablet market where before there was a bunch of like nothing. And Ultrabooks, they carved out a new segment. And even if the Apple stuff now isn't anywhere near the front of the pack, like with some of the Ultrabook stuff, the fact that they did that trailblazing and made that market, we're all better for it. Even if we aren't using Apple stuff, even if we're using Dells that are shaped now. Like, I mean, they've all got little island style keyboards. They've all got super duper thin bezels. They've got massive long battery life, and these are all great pieces of hardware.
Plastic is
the only thing
complaint.
That they tend to lack yeah. is they tend to not have sometimes, and this is I don't want to overgeneralize, some of them the keyboards aren't quite up to snuff, and the other thing is the touchpad thing Apple has managed that they managed to stay ahead
that's
on.
That's a really, really good point. And in fact, that's kind of the differentiator still is the touchpad, because if you show me, I challenge anybody to show me a Windows OEM, any other OEM that's not Apple, with a trackpad that doesn't suck, and you will not be able to. You may think that yours doesn't suck, but then use
Lee
one
will
on a Mac.
School you.
Use one on a Mac. I mean, it's a combination of extremely responsive extra gestures. And I'm not talking like the crazy, like, six-finger crazy gestures that you get into when you're, like, trying to swap 15 window positions around. I mean, just, like, something as simple as two-finger scrolling or a double two-finger tap to right-click and a three-finger window drag. Just basic stuff. You get onto an HP laptop that looks beautiful or a Dell laptop that looks beautiful, and it looks beautiful right up until you start moving the trackpad around, and then you're like, oh my God, I need to plug in an external mouse because I'm ready to murder people here.
And that's them not yet caught up with the prior touchpads, and now there's the – I haven't gotten to fiddle with one, but the, you know, Force Touch, whatever, newest, latest and greatest touchpad yeah. – generally, the reviews seem to have been pretty strong with it, so
yeah, well, no
I'm
more
thinking it's them moving farther ahead.
Yep, no more soon once the reviews on the big reviews start to hit. The hands-ons were all real positive. Yeah, I mean, a lot of that's a driver thing. I mean, on the software side, a lot of it is the fact that there are OEMs are sourcing trackpads from a very limited number of vendors, and in not like Apple's doing, where they're using the same hardware that a lot of other people are using, but are writing their driver stack from scratch. A lot of the Windows OEMs just repackage the manufacturer's drivers and the absolute terrible software that comes with them. And that's why your trackpads on Windows are all terrible, even though they look nice. They still suck.
It makes one wonder, you know, Michael Dell doesn't have to answer to shareholders anymore. You you'd almost wonder what would happen if he made a Dell that would happen to take, that would happen to be practically Hackintoshed right out of the box.
Well, that's a complicated issue because you can't just decide to go and make something like that. I mean, half of the reason, maybe even more than half of the reason that Apple produces the quality of products that they produce is because Tim Cook, the CEO, is a absolute megalomaniacal evil genius when it comes to external vendor relations and supply chain management. And Apple has, through Tim Cook's, that's kind of been his biggest legacy and his biggest contribution towards Apple is establishing their supply chain dominancy such that when they need parts, they get them. They get them over other OEMs because they've got the market demand and presence. So to get, like, for another OEM like a Dell to try to produce, you know, the pie in the sky laptop that they want to make, like you said, kind of like, you know, all bets are off, let's make the best laptop ever, they might not be able to do it and meet the same price point as like a MacBook Air just because they don't have that. They don't have that iron
economies
control
of scale. Yeah.
Yeah, they don't have it. They may want to source those new parts in, but if it means disrupting product lines, changing manufacturing around, they may just not be able to do it. And that's not just Dell. I mean, you know, we're kind right. of picking on Dell, but that's every OEM ever. And that's kind of where that's like the hidden secret behind Apple's massive success is an almost like brutal Walmart style just fear and dominance on the supply chain side. And it pays off when you can make, you know, Apple owns just a ridiculous number of CNC aluminum milling machines, more than like almost any other company on earth, because so many of their products are made out of aluminum and it gives them the ability to execute on, you know, aluminum products. It's stuff like that. It's not,
yeah, that was,
it's not sexy that was stuff, one of the, but that's what it
go
is.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
That's one of the biggest things. I think it's one of the unrecognized things that Steve Jobs did is he saw that the PC OEM, the kind of cozy environment they had all slipped into was very reactive. It's like, oh, hey, this new thing is kind of is fairly cheap. Okay, well, put them on all the units. And he saw things like, well, what's coming next? Solid state drives. And Apple bet heavy. And if they had bet wrong, they would have been in the soup pretty bad, but they bet right. And so when it came time, they had, you know, when they put it out there and had successful machines with solid state drives and that, then when everybody else went to do the same thing and knock it off like they always used to, Apple had locked up the market and had price advantage and all that, where they used to be close followers who got the discount because they came just a little bit late to the show, and Apple made them pay for it.
Exactly.
And I guess on the final try buyer fry, this one's free, so that there's, you know, pretty much you probably should try if you have any interest in it. I found an article that has, you know, the animated GIF has gone from being, you know, equivalent to the Blink tool up to actually a sort of advanced form of communication if you look when you translate a video into a GIF. And I found an article in PC World that has three fast, easy ways to find an animated GIF that you can, you know, stick into your blog post or tweet out to your
Tumblr. Tweet out to your Tumblr with your Snapchats or whatever the teenagers
yeah, so,
are doing these
days. Hulu has one. Called the perfect GIF or perfect GIF.
No, it's GIF. Just keep saying GIF.
the thing with theirs is it's got animated GIFs from Hulu's TV collection. So there's stuff from Star Trek, Castle, Modern Family, etc. And you can search them by hashtag. The one that I think is probably the biggest, if you're looking to find interesting animated GIFs, is called Giphy, G-I-P-H-Y. Yeah, they're Giphy, if you want to pronounce it where you pronounce every letter. Giphy has a thing where you can find, it's got probably the most extensive collection, and you can do multi-word searches to find that perfect animated GIF. And then finally, YouTube has a way to complete some of your own. There's a GIF creation tool at YouTube. It's only offered, that feature is only offered on a limited number of videos, But there's some stuff like if you want to make an animated GIF from content by Epic Rap Battles of History, PBS Idea Channel, or Vsauce, then YouTube is a great place to go. There's also Imgur has a video to GIF tool that lets you convert segments from many online videos to an animated GIF.
Yeah, but it doesn't work with Vivo videos on YouTube, so you can't pull like your favorite Beyonce video and make Beyonce GIFs. Not that I know that.
And then if you look around, if you're into making them yourself, do some research because you can make them frame by frame. Obviously, converting video is kind of cool and easy, but you can make, and I made some way back in the day, I made some animated GIFs that had a lot of frames to them and used them when it wasn't easy to do like screen recording for actions. You could make animated GIFs that would, kind of illustrate what people needed to do on like tutorials and stuff.
Let me just say too, as kind of an old hand at these computer things, watching the slow re-rise of GIF after the past, almost 30 years since the format was first introduced has just been really weird because GIF used to be, back in the BBS days, in the early 90s when I was first getting into the Houston BBS scene, GIF was the primary format that you would download images in. Because JPEGs were too large, GIF was limited to 256 colors, and generally if you were downloading PICs, they were GIFs. And then as file transfer speeds increased and you switched from BBSs to internets, JPEG sort of took over as the predominant format for interchanging images because it was, more colors, the definition was higher, and, it was just a better image format for images that were supposed to be true-to-life images. But GIF always had that ability to display animated frames kind of in the background, and just over the past, I don't know, five, maybe too short, but over the past maybe 5 to 7 years, watching that like slow climb in popularity of animated GIFs has been really weird. It's just been like, we're flashing back to the 90s again. And we were having the same arguments then too about like, whether it was GIF or GIF or whatever. This is not a new argument. This is like stuff we were arguing about in the late 80s.
Well, yeah. Well, and one of the other things I think that made the GIF work way back when was, when Windows was really only maxed out at, 8-bit. So there were only so many colors, a lot of the time using Windows 3.1.1.
Yeah, you're either using a BMP file, which was too big to download, or a GIF.
And it'd be, and the other cool thing is if you made a GIF on a Mac and then you took it over to a PC, the colors were mapped. That was one of the hacks that they did to make Windows work, is they hacked the color palette. And so when you made it on a Mac and it looked all perfect, you would take it over to Windows, and if you had made the wrong color choices, it would turn
perfect.
Into something different. It would look really crappy.
It would look like you were tripping. You're tripping on your GIFs. That bit of retro computing nostalgia was brought to you by Graphic Interchange Format.
And I'm surprised that, the sad thing is, part of why GIF kind of faded is because there was, I think, CompuServe or somebody who owned it was trying to make rights issues.
There was a licensing thing.
A lot of people over to JPEG, and there was
and
a
Ping.
Time when a lot of the, and Ping too, a lot of the Linux distributions, like the ones that prided themselves on having no non-free
That's
software
right.
in there, they dropped support for it. There was a point when the GIMP dropped support for it, where if you wanted to be able to edit those, you had to go get an external package. All that's kind of died away. Like, it's pretty easy. It's
if only somebody had done animated Ping.
Well, the thing is, I think they did. I think there was a Ping animation extension. The thing is, though, GIF is a terrible format. It is a garbage format that has absolutely no redeeming qualities except the animation. And then over the past few years, it's been absolutely just ripped apart and redone because, the primary limitation of GIF is that it's 256 colors mapped. So you can display, I don't know what the total palette is, but you have a maximum of 256 colors in the map. But you see these animated GIFs that are up on Imgur or all these other sites, and they're clearly not 256 colors. These are clearly like true color GIFs. And it's all because, the format has just been all hacked all to crap now. And you sit there and you kind of think this is terrible. We should have some kind of new format for exchanging images. And then you run into that old like XKCD argument about like this is broken and we need a new standard. And now we have one more competing standard when we're done. It's, you know, it's kind of, it is the situation that we're at is that we're using GIFs again because they're kind of the best tool to do a stupid task.
Well, because they work, but which is, again, why, though, I wish that they had where, you know, they, you know, Ping, they did a lot with it, and it's very useful. I know when it comes time for me to do something that has, that needs to be transparent, I don't save
town,
it
baby.
As a GIF. I go Ping, Ping 24-bit, and it works, and it looks right, and you can have drop shadows, and you can do a lot of the cool things that you can't do with a GIF. And, so if they just would have added that piece, then the whoever, you know, obviously it's an open format, but then it would be very useful to the whole internet, and it's open, and it would be kind of a win for doing it the right way.
These computers are stupid. Throw them in a cave and hide forever. There's no future in these computer things.
True. Well, here's something with a future in it, just to do a quick, as we run down, I thought this was an interesting story, and I guess before I would do that, I don't have a spare speaker.
Don't we have I can play the bumper. I can bump us in. Here we go.
Awesome.
Hang on.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're going to see some serious
science.
All right. Well, you know, when we think about the dinosaurs and stuff, we've talked about this on past episodes of Weird Science on Tech Bytes, you know, about the colorfulness and, you know, feathers and all that stuff where everybody thought the dinosaurs were, you know, like gray and leathery. And it turns out they have, you know, that they maybe had feathers and were colorfully marked and all that. Well, fossilized seashells, you know, ancient, you know, millions of years old, million-year-old seashells, they found out that using ultraviolet light that they can reclaim the lost colors on certain shells. So they've been examining the ancient cone snail shells that are millions of years old and have discovered several new species because of the colors. And they have the pictures, and they actually look pretty cool. You know, at first you see them, and they're just sort of white and various shades of off-white. And then they do the UV thing, and they come out with these. They do them. They look at them in UV, and then they can take and make a photograph that shows the where they can adjust the pigmentation so that you can see where the what the coloring would have been. So thought that one was kind of cool, and you know, so you seem to be able to learn something new every day from even just white old shells that were sitting around. I guess another science thing, quickly, a couple small things. Bell Labs, which hasn't really been heard from a lot, you know, I mean, they still exist, and they had, you know, Nobel laureates and stuff, but they had to show people they still exist and give a sneak peek at some of the projects that are part of their vision for networks in 2020, they had an event today, and they are working on the other. Bell Labs is pushing against the laws of physics to improve network performance. Part of their plan for 5G is a pint-sized base station or a small cell that can generate its own power by using solar energy, and so that it could be deployed kind of all over the place. It would use MIMO. And 5G, they're working on a prototype air interface for 5G called Universal Filtered, OFDM. I'm not going to get into that one until they actually start building it. But the air interface is what sends and receives data in the mobile network, and the technology that Bell Labs is working on promises to be more efficient than what current 4G networks use. The base stations don't have to talk as much to connected devices and vice versa, which gives you more battery life and networks that can handle more devices faster. So the other thing, though, is they've been trying to push more broadband over copper. Operators like British Telecom and Telecom Austria are backing something called G-Fast, a new technology that increases broadband over telephone wires to hundreds of megabits per second, using more spectrum and advanced measures for getting rid of interference. Building on the advancements in GFast, Bell Labs can transmit speeds at up to 10 gigabits per second, over plain old telephone stuff, copper wire. Although right now it only works for about 30 meters.
Aren't most U.S. carriers that are rolling out IP-based services, aren't they wanting to pull and reclaim all of the copper that they've run out in the residential areas? I thought I read something about that relatively recently.
I think here, because they want, I think they want to go to VoIP and use the internet network instead of the plain old telephone system.
I think it was Verizon. I mean, when this is U.S., you're talking a little bit there, but I heard you talk about the U.K. some too, but.
Yeah, it was British, BT and BT. Telecom Austria.
But in the U.S., I know Verizon and maybe the other local exchange carriers that have all inherited the earth. Are trying to reclaim a lot of that copper because it's valuable. Well, huge amounts of money that's just basically sitting buried.
Yeah, they're reclaiming it before the poor do.
Before it gets like bubbles in the wire.
On fiber optic, though, Bell Labs is working on optical networking technologies that can take advantage of fibers that have multiple cores and send 1 terabyte per second of data over each. Boy, there's the Google. So much for gigabit internet from Google. I'm waiting for terabyte internet from Google.
You can host the whole internet from your closet.
Just like the cores on processors can handle different tasks, different traffic can be sent down the fiber cores.
Of course, you want that, but at the same time, it's not just the line that they'd run. It's those 2 19-inch racks that they'd have to set up in your garage, and the 4 extra 100-amp circuit breakers they'd have to install to power the equipment. It comes with kind of a long tail too.
Yeah, and also there's a lot of interference when you squeeze that many cores into a fiber, which is where they start running up against the laws of physics. And the final science story, this one, there's always battery stories. I've decided to put them in the science section until they're actually shipping something. Right now we use lithium batteries because they have the highest energy density. But apparently, there are doubts about how much energy density can be increased using lithium. So there have been researchers looking into other materials. One of the more promising alternatives is aluminum. It's abundant, cheap, and lightweight, and each atom of aluminum has the potential to liberate up to 3 electrons during charge-discharge cycles.
That's a lot of electrons.
Lithium only has one, but the batteries themselves have been disappointing so far, with performance dropping radically after a few cycles. So researchers say they have now managed to make an aluminum battery that's stable to over 7,000 cycles, is flexible, and poses no fire risk. And so it doesn't take advantage of some of aluminum's more appealing properties, so there's more work left to be done.
Sounds like we can't lose. We can't lose.
So at some point your aluminum MacBook will maybe the aluminum on it will be part of the battery.
Well, these kind of battery technologies seem like they're perpetually in that 3 to 5 years away bucket, and then you revisit it in 2 years and it's 3 to 5 years away.
Still waiting for my fuel cells. Yeah. Thank you very much.
This one uses graphene foam, so it's got cool kind of unobtainium in it to make it even more cool.
It's powered by science. Science!
All right, well, that music tells me that it is time for us to hit the road. Gonna pick up our landlines and go home.
Click.
Click. Well, it's been another exciting episode of Don't Pick Up Chicks with Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And he's
Groovehouse.
Groovehouse.
Howdy. If Saturday represents your chance to get away from the grind of the weekday, to be able to kick back and get to what it is that you want to do, then you'll need a soundtrack. You'll need Deadbeat. Each Saturday from 3 to 6 p.m., the crew at Deadbeat will bring you the best of what you haven't and have not heard along the path less frequently traveled. From blues to bluegrass, jam to Jerry, folk to rock, and including live performance from bands both near and just passing through town, Deadbeat will melt in your mind and not in your ears. So join us each week for those tracks that are a little bit deeper. And remember to support commercial-free, listener-sponsored community radio, 90.1 KPFT Houston.
On May 7th, proposed bylaws amendments will be taken up for acceptance or rejection by the Pacifica National Board. If any are approved by the PNB, local station delegates' assemblies will have until no later than July 6th to take them up for acceptance or rejection. You can view an amendment concerning in-person meetings and an amendment to reduce the size of the Pacifica National Board, the two items up for review, at pacifica.org. You are welcome to share comments with the National Board at pnb@pacifica.org. KPFT, Houston.